dinner, and she's going to tell us about correlations, one way to deal with correlations at home events.
Afternoon, and buon appetito. Yes, I'll be talking about this correlation and multi-band systems. And an appropriate subtitle of this talk would be, let's say, many body theory of real materials. So, something a bit ambitious as far as real materials are concerned. What I mean by real materials, of course, is that we are interested in describing the many body properties of real, let's say, solid systems like metals, compounds, cuprates. And these systems, these real systems, are very complicated. They exhibit a very complicated single particle states. They have complicated band structures, bonding, hybridization between different orbitals and between different species, atomic species. So all this complication is something important, which is an important part of the physics of these systems, and we want to have a tool to include all this complication in many-body theory. Of course, many-body theory has to do with correlation effects, which are as well as important when you are dealing with localized systems. So, what I will be describing is a possible way to match these two worlds, the many-body, which is usually applied to model systems, and the real materials described by, let's say, single particle band structure. Of course, as far as the many-body part of the problem is concerned, we, of course, need a theory which possibly is non-perturbative, because we want to possibly describe systems which are in the highly correlated regime. So non-perturbative, and moreover, the best thing is it to be non-mean field. A mean field theory would not be able to describe short-lived excitations which are present in this system. So we want a theory which is non-perturbative and beyond mean field. The general scheme which seems appropriate to describe this narrow band, these highly localized systems, is the Hubbard, or generalized Hubbard Hamiltonian, which, as everybody knows, is just dominated by this interplay between the hopping and the local correlation. So this interplay between itinerant character, well described, let's say, by band theory, and local correlations. So what we want to do is to augment band theory with local correlation. So a point which is very important is to establish a clear connection between the two Hamiltonians, let's say, the band Hamiltonian and the Hubbard or generalized Hubbard Hamiltonian. So I would like to start just by writing down some very simple, very well-known formulas. First of all, let's say the exact Hamiltonian in second quantization and using localized basis set, which can be written in this way. It's a bit lengthy because of all the symbols and things, but I mean, let's write it like that. Which is obvious. Okay, I want to keep all the indices. This is the, of course, the single particle part. I means the site, alpha and beta the orbitals, and this is the single particle part, obviously, of the Hamiltonian. Then you have the body, the many body part associated to electron-electron interaction, and so you have, let's say. Okay. Except some constant, of course. Plus the same interaction related to the parallel spins involving also the exchange integral, obviously. And so you have plus all the rest of it, plus multicenter integrals, plus quantities involving different orbitals, and so on and so forth. So, why do I write down this very well-known exact Hamiltonian? Because different approximations can be obtained just treating in different ways, for instance, treating in according to mean field different part of the Hamiltonian. If you want to develop a single particle, you have to map all these many body parts according to mean treated in mean field into the single particle one. If you, on the other hand, if you want to include part of the exact electron-electron interaction. Exactly, I mean, just as a true many-body term, you just need to take care of this according to mean field, map it back in the single particle part, and so on and so forth. This means that if you write down a mean field or a band Hamiltonian, you would have something like that, mean field, which is different from these bare energies, obviously, and this is it. You have mapped all the many body parts treated according to mean field into these energies, plus, of course, the hopping. Okay. Okay. While the Hubbard approach, you just treat in mean field all the rest of this part, all the multi-center and multi-orbital integrals. So this means that okay, let me write down. So if you want to come to the Hubbard Hamiltonian, you drop this term or the repeating to these energies, and so you end up with this form. So this means that these energies, the AH, are related to this quantity. The difference between them is just a mean field treatment of this term. Let me write down with the proper symbols and things. So, okay. Okay, so this is the exact relationship that you have between Hubbard energies and mean field energies. You, in order to solve your Hubbard Hamiltonian without a double counting of the electron-electron interaction, if you want to start to augment band eigenvalues, this is what you have to do, to remove from them the mean field expression of the on-site interaction and put it back again, but treated not in mean field but according to a many-body theory that I will be describing later.
For concrete applications, would you extract these parameters in this effective Hamiltonian from an initial calculation of some kind of the Menier calculation?
You mean,
can you say something on that procedure?
The parameters, you mean, the
yeah,
U and
the
J?
And the J's and the
okay,
J's.
Okay. In principle, you can do that. For instance, if you are in, if you want to adopt a density function theory, you can perform constrained density function. Otherwise, you can an alternative approach is to calculate these quantities as screened Coulomb integrals. Just once you have fixed your basis, your localized basis, you can calculate Coulomb integrals, exchange integrals, and then the difficult thing is to understand how to screen them. In a solid, in a microscopic system, it is pretty difficult. I mean, you have to take into account all the screening correctly. There are systems like mesoscopic systems where if I have time, I will say something about that. But the screening is much simpler to be described, and so this is more feasible.
So there are actually two issues there, right? It's how to find the T's and the U's, and also how to find the best values. Because there is an issue, I mean, you've written this in a certain basis set.
Yeah. This is quite simple. I mean, the basis should be as much localized as you can, of course, because this allows you to assume the multi-center orbital and are not involved. So, I mean, this the Hubbard Hamiltonian would in fact be much more similar to the exact one. But the issue of you can always change basis, of course, just with the unitary transformation. So, in principle, you have to have a very localized basis set. But as in any band structure calculation, you can then come to a block extended basis set just with the unitary transformation.
Yes, well, I'm sure at the end we will discuss this more, but presumably by band structure you mean an LDA.
Well, it can be Hartree-Fock or LDA.
Hartree-Fock, there would be no problem. Then you know precisely what you're doing, and you solve the Hartree-Fock. But nobody in his right mind would start dealing with iron, cobalt, and nickel, or a superconductor in a Hartree-Fock approximation. That just
Raven,
you would never get anywhere.
Well, there has been papers published on just using the method I will be describing, this Fadeyev equation starting from Hartree-Fock, from this Japanese guy.
Yeah, well, probably you want to do some semiconductors and get the gas. When you have a gap, it's different, but for a metal, Hartree-Fock is...
I agree on that. I mean, maybe we'll discuss later. I mean, I'll come to the point.
You can actually do this in directly polar oxides, when you can provide gap insulator.
Also cuprates.
No, there's no more sizable gap.
Yeah.
I could ask a question of principle, I guess. To what extent is a neglect of multi-center integrals a theoretical wishful dream, and how far is it physical fact? I mean, I can sort of refer to Horry here, for instance, with his whole supportive theory guy, who's actually stressing very much that, you know, these multi-center integrals could contain essential pieces of physics. I know we all saw them away. And you argue that they get less important when the orbits are localized. I agree, but are they really getting so unimportant that you can't throw them away in good faith? Do you have some critics about it?
In solids, I have no such a feeling. In other systems, I have, and I know they are very important. I mean, in this mesoscopic system, they are very important. All what I can say is that actually you are not throwing away these multicenter integrals, but just mapping them in principle as a mean field correction and include them in these energies. So you are not throwing them away. You are assuming that the fluctuations involved in these integrals are less important in a way. So this is just what I can say.
So something related to that is that although you want your basis functions to be localized, you also want to assume that they are orthogonal, because you don't want to have to deal with all the complications. And if they really are Lebesgue functions, then these questions you raise about intra-atomic processes become a little bit
actually
more
the problem is that if you want to create indeed orthogonal Hamiltonian without those multi-center terms, then it will have very long range Hamiltonian. That is the problem. Oleg Anderson group tried to construct ab initio Hamiltonians, and they made rigorous way to map down orthogonal system, and that means that obviously we have very far long-range interactions.
Mm-hmm. As far as the electron-electron interaction is concerned?
No, just Hopkins. Hopkins enough.
Well, Hopkins.
Hopkins is
treated, I mean, correctly. You don't bother about Hopkins. The problem is, this is correctly described in advanced theory.
The interaction is definitely sizable. It's definitely very sizable. It's very important. Another story that usually, from a major part of interactions, you could include it into the Heidegger term. But still, there are some effects which are described by intercycle interaction is definitely not small.
Yeah.
Question on Gadigan's question. So, do I understand correctly that if you use this sort of projection that Ole Andersen has developed, you find that the TRJ decay very slowly, gamma minus J?
If you want them to be orthogonal.
How slowly?
It depends on the system, definitely. But just the result.
Parallel.
So if you agree to have non-orthogonal, then you could have quite one two neighbors. But if you say that I want to be orthogonal, they become very slow.
Well, I don't know if I got it right, but I mean, I think that the problem is not much to do with hopping, I want to stress, but with this terms, because hopping in principle, I mean, the best thing, since we are interested in periodic systems, is to write down this Hamiltonian in a block basis set, and if you do this part, and you can do this, the single particle part is diagonal, and you get, if you use a block, k-space, and this is actually what I have done. I mean, you can write in this in k-space, and then you have the first part is obviously, I mean, K N band index, sigma, K N sigma, and this is it for the first part. Then you have something much more complicated with K and K prime and P and all the rest of it, which is the Hubbard part. So, actually, this is the form that I have used. Maybe it's worthwhile writing them accurately, or even with constant. So, let me use this. I'll make the notation clear when I have finished. Expansion coefficient of the extended block wave functions in terms of localized orbitals, this C of band index N, alpha and spin sigma, and then you would have the creation and destruction operator in this basis. This is quite trivial, I mean, it's just a unitary transformation you can perform. Just a minute, I finished to write down this very lengthy thing, plus U and J.
What quantity are you going to come to?
My goal at the moment, I'm just writing down the Hamiltonian, and then I want to solve it. This is the main thing, I agree. Means writing down the one particle propagator and calculating spectral functions, and this is what... Just to see how the bands, the single particle bands become quasi-particle bands in a way, okay? It's just a matter of length. It's a problem. It was just to say that the hopping terms, the multi-center, this hopping between different centers, is no problem if you describe your Hamiltonian in a block basis, because everything becomes diagonal and you have to bother only of this term, just the Hubbard or generalized Hubbard term in a extended basis set. This is what you have to do. So, coming to the solution of this thing, which is the most interesting part, of course, a possible way to solve, in a sense I was saying before, this Hamiltonian, calculating green functions and single particle propagators and spectral function, is to adopt, this is what I've been doing, an extension of the configuration interaction scheme to the solid state. So this is obviously non-perturbative, and this is it can be, I mean, this configuration interaction scheme can be extended to the solid state. If you, and with this I mean that what I'll, beg your pardon?
The usual combination of the N to the 7.
Sorry, I didn't get it.
How the number of electrons can go grow to infinity?
No, but I mean.
No, that's the correlation energy part is not size extended. It's not proportional to the volume. I mean,
I see. Okay. I'll be. Of course, if I have time, I mean, I just come into it and maybe. Okay. So, as in any configuration interaction scheme, your expansion will be exact if you use the complete set of configuration. What we have been doing is the following. You can build up different configuration. Configuration meaning Slater determinants, that is solutions of the non-interacting problem. And you can, in principle, write down all of them. If you are interested, as I am, in the excitation, the spectral function, for instance, for one electron removal, so the total energy of the system with one particle removed, you would be interested in a configuration of this kind. Let me write down schematically like that. So this is the density or state of the non-interacting system, and this is the ground state for the non-interacting system n minus one particle. Then, of course, you should include all the excited states, like that, or like that. That is the state that you can build up by adding electron-hole pairs to your system with the non-interacting system with one particle removed. Then you go on. So considering five particles, seven particles, and so on and so forth, adding more and more electron-hole pairs.
You mean the ground state, meaning ground state of N?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I do, because what I'm going to do is to cut this expansion, as is usually done in any configuration expansion, just at the first level. And if you, just including one electron hole pair, if you do this, and if you go back, you use the same cutting in the n-particle system, you easily see that your interacting system coincides with the non-interacting one.
What I meant, the substance,
yeah.
The correlation machine. The correlation part of the energy is not quite extended if you're balanced within the thermodynamic limit. I mean, if you do that for a small molecule, your
transit
energy is not that of the non-interacting system.
Well, if it's not true. I mean, if you, if you go on in configuration, I mean, adding more and more.
Just to do that, but it's not.
But if you cut at some level, not including all of them, I mean, I agree that if you include just one electron or particle in the n particle system, you are not going to add anything. I mean, your correlation is not there. But if you do this in the n minus 1, which is what I want to do, because I want to describe how correlation effects affect the response of the system when you remove one particle, you are going to do that. I mean, I agree on that. I mean, this is just a comment on this point, which comes to this, which is the best starting point, LDO Atrefov. In this sense, even if it introduces a slight inconsistency, as Balazs was saying also yesterday, and things like that. I mean, since you are using configuration interaction at this level, including just one electron or particle, and since this would not allow you to include correlation in the neutral system, in the system ground state of the n particle system, the best thing to do is to describe it according to a mean field which is as good as you can. So in this sense, LDA can be better than Atrefov, because if you would include more and more configuration, maybe the starting point would not be so important, but because you are reducing your number of configuration, it's better to start from a more realistic, let's say, system. So I'm going to discuss correlation effects in which come into play to describe the removal of one particle, and according to this scheme where you have this configurations up to this level. If you do this, and I'll show you using this view graph. This is what. Oh. Okay. This is what I've been saying. Now this is the configurations which we will consider, and what you do is to project the Hubbard Hamiltonian in K space using the project it on this configuration. So what you get is an appropriate effective Hamiltonian to describe the n minus 1 particle. And you do this here, m and m prime refer just to the possible configuration with one particle or with three particles. And if you do this, the effective Hamiltonian would come out as the sum of three contributions involving matrix elements between different types of configurations, let's say involving one particle, three particle, and the interaction between the two, the matrix element connecting one, this configuration, and these. So one particle, three particle, and the interaction between the two. In turn, this H3, the part of the Hamiltonian, the matrix elements connecting different three particle states, three particle configurations, can be written in turn as a sum of a diagonal part plus an effective whole hole scattering and another electron hole scattering. So the effective Hamiltonian would have this expression, and the difficult part to be dealt with is this one, which involves multiple whole hole and electron hole scattering.
What is M?
It's just the configuration, so it can be one particle, spans all the configuration that we have included.
And there are many body states.
Oh, of course, so yes.
What do the L indicate?
Errors means spin. Spin. Okay, so this is written for a ferromagnetic system. The problem is that, as I was saying, we want to calculate the spectral functions for this system, so green functions, one particle propagators. This can be done, obviously, And we have done this. So what we are interested in are spectral functions. So you have K index and spin index dependent spectral function, and of course the dependence on the energy, which are the obviously the imaginary part of the whole green function, which is this one, and the this G is the whole resolvent, that is the resolvent where H n minus 1 is this effective Hamiltonian that I've been showing you. The ground state is ferromagnetic, yes. So in this context, the ground state, as we were saying before, is the non-interacting one because of this.
No.
This is the starting point. So I'm starting from a ferromagnetic ground state as it is calculated from, let's say, band theory. Because this, the way I'm including correlation is not going, as we were saying before, is not going to correct, to include correlation, because I'm dropping the expansion at the first level. So the ground state of the n particle system is non-interacting.
And the only place where it goes is
that
the propagator is
ferromagnetic,
right?
I expect a spin-dependent spectral function at the end, okay? And the spin-dependent corrections, self-energy corrections as well.
It doesn't have to be ferromagnetic, right?
Sorry, say it again.
It does not have to be ferromagnetic, but you're studying a particular case where you have a nickel
or something of the type. If I'm interested in nickel, it will be ferromagnetic. Of course. This is more general. It's a spin dependent, and so. You can. Or maybe where? I didn't get it.
You
include both U and J. There is no problem in doing that.
Interaction goes on the top of the ferromagnetic ground state, which has been assumed at the beginning, right?
You are using this U and J to see how the system, which has U and J incorporated in a mean field, let's say, how this U and J affect the let's say photoemission spectrum, the spectral function. This is how it goes.
I guess you're basically saying LSTA is a pretty good CV for the ground state of itinerant ferromagnets.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Perfectly true.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you have to do many body theory to do the excitation.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the point. Yeah.
Strategy.
Okay.
Can I back to the question of size consistency, one has also brought up already. I'm not convinced that this is a systematic tree, because I would think that if you properly treat the n particle ground states in lowest order with say exponentiated particle excitation scheme size consistently, then that would correct in lowest order your propagator. It contributes to your propagator. So the process which you have taken into account, I think the problem is not that trivial. I think one should properly treat the full ground state, the extensive ground state, to, in the same spirit, with a kind of cluster.
You are saying that you are not allowed to cut the expansion at this very, very low level, in a sense.
No, but that's what she's saying, because she's saying that this is the interaction with the
I agree that for instance, in perturbation theory, if you go on adding perturbation terms,
afraid that it's in the lowest order. Not solving the problem correctly. In addition to having one particle hole, they are added for the hole,
state,
yeah,
should really have
more than that.
Finite density of particle hold pairs in the ground state.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I mean, if you do this,
contribute to lowest order. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Actually, an alternative strategy that I'm planning to follow now is to, I don't see a way to solve this problem in this scheme. I mean, there is no way to do this because you don't know the exact interactive state. So the problem is for the n particle system. A possible alternative strategy would be to use this configuration interaction in k-space and use exact diagonalization. I mean, I'm currently trying this way, and in this way, in principle, you can include more configurations. But I mean, calculating propagators, I don't know how to do. I mean, not in this, according to this approach.
I mean, sort of factual question in this regard. I mean, I could imagine that the lowest energy state in the N minus one spectrum could actually cost the ground state energy when you don't treat them consistently, right? There's an increase in Hilbert space at the lower energy in generally, where you give the N minus one part of the problem a bigger Hilbert space than the N part of the problem, then you get sort of a negative sort of negative. I guess it doesn't happen in your calculation. It's always so that the
I'm treating the n particle and n minus particle system consistently because
if you could collate a whole wave function and electron wave function, then you could have not much. Yeah,
let's try to get to some results.
Okay. So, this is. I didn't say much word about the Fadeyev solution, which is just a way to solve the problem to solve a three particle scattering problem. But it's somewhat technical, and so I wouldn't go in that detail. I want just to show you how the self-energy would come out, and also diagrammatically, which maybe can say something to you. And so if you do this three-particle scattering theory, you end up with the self-energy, which is written as a combination of this three-particle resolvent that I had no time to introduce, actually, and this potential connecting the three particle and one particle configuration, which are all proportional to U, either to U or U minus J. Diagrammatically, you can see that the self-energy would have this form, where you have this three particle green function and interaction between holes and electron and holes. And someone noticed that these diagrams look very similar to Parquet equations, but I don't know nothing about that, so maybe someone knows more. So let me show you some results. And results for model systems, which are not the one we are interested in, but all the same can say something. This is how we calculate self-energy, the real part and the imaginary part, starting from this red density of state. So we have a non-interacting system with the square box density of state, a model system, half occupied, and we can try to switch on Hubbard U. In this case, it was just U, not U and J. So it's a paramagnetic system, half occupied, zero is the Fermi energy, and you can calculate spectral functions for one particle removal and one particle addition, so D minus and D plus, the hole and particle green functions, and these are these black lines here, and you see that this is the result of all the calculation after you have included self-energy correction. You see that the spectral functions differ even for very small u compared to the bandwidth you smaller, I would say half the bandwidth, you would have the removal of spectral wave from the lower binding energy and the coming up of this so-called satellite structure.
This integrated over all K, or is that specific?
Yeah, yeah. No. This is the total. Total.
Okay. What about mention of sigma on the frame? Is it a jump?
Yeah, there is a jump. It's definitely a jump, and you expect a jump in this context, because otherwise you would not recover ever the atomic limit. If you have a continuous self-energy, you would always...
You will already have...
Yeah.
No, but I think what you mean is that sigma minus and sigma plus are for the two spin species?
No. For electron and holes. So
given spin.
Yeah, this is a paramagnetic case, so you have... if you add, if you remove a particle or add a particle, this is non-perturbative. I mean, in perturbation theory, it is actually continuous.
So this is not a metal or something?
I mean, it is a metal, as you can see. I mean, but it can become an insulator if you go on increasing U. In perturbation theory.
We can try to put it on a practical footing, right? I mean, the quasi part of the energy is epsilon plus minus the real part of the energy, right? Now, when it's in gap, wouldn't you expect another gap, I would say, because the sigma minus pushes the electrons down, and the sigma plus pushes the electrons up?
No, you would not expect...
It's not consistent with Fermi liquid theory to have a gap.
No. I mean, it's not. I mean, it's non-Fermi liquid theory. I agree on that. I mean, because it's not. It is not a perturbation theory.
Fermi liquid theory is not perturbation.
Well.
It's a very strong
biological. Yeah, I know. But you never get the atomic limit if you have a continuous...
The atomic limit is not a metal, so it's supposed to be...
Well, but you can, I mean, you can think of in a model to switch on correlation, and just if you increase Hubbard U, you expect to have a metal at some level, and then the atomic limit. So, I mean, this is what... You wouldn't? I would. Yeah, and in fact it is insulating.
But if you look at small U's, did you then get a continuous self-energy?
I do not get a continuous self-energy, but I do get a metal. So it does, I mean... These lines are... are just omega minus a epsilon cutting, so they would indicate the poles of the Green function. So you have, this is real part of self-energy, and this is because of the scale is very small. So this gap is very small, because you should look at this scale, but there is there. And these lines are omega minus epsilon. The epsilon meaning the bottom of this density of state, the Fermi level, and the
theta.
Okay, this is a model system. In this context, is not K dependent, because I'm using a model system. But in real materials, I would have. I'll show you later.
I guess my neighbor came with a suggestion for this. This is also purely a question, right? The lowest energy state of the n minus one particle system and then of the n plus one particle system is that connected, can sort of shift to each other. Isn't it so that this jump at the end, the second self energy, is exactly doing that, so that electron like state become hole like and hole like state become electron like?
Actually, what you are doing here is you are, for instance, let's consider EF. So this is the energy zero here, and this straight line corresponds to omega minus zero, minus EF. And you see that you, in this case, because the system is a metal, you have a pole both in the in the hole part and in the electron part. And
this is because the argument would be in order to keep hole state, electron state, electron state, self-energy should be the real part should be continuous at the end, right? And naturally vanishing because otherwise you're in a big shift area. This is continuity, and it has to mean that you move level. Right, the electron left was either moved away from me yet, through me yet.
Yeah.
And but the guess is that you do the second one because of the device.
No, my, the point is, I mean, this is, I mean, I agree that this is a sort of intriguing point, and what we have thought it was the case is that you are assuming that the Fermi energy is the non-interacting one, because your ground state, for the neutral system is still non-interacting. So if you do this, and if you do the theory consistently for n and n minus 1, you have the Fermi energy is still the same as before, zero, it does not change, and you have a correct way to discriminate between whole and particle states, and moreover this is half occupied, so the Fermi energy must be there just for symmetry reason. So whole states are those which occur even after self-energy correction below Fermi energy and particle states above Fermi energy. This is how things go.
Okay.
In this model calculation, but in real systems, I simply introduce the k-dependence. I show you a real system. Okay. Go ahead.
So that cannot be safe. That's not a physical statement.
Well, you must consider the fact. Listen, this is not the self energy. This is the this is the self-energy for holes and particles. Then you use the analyticity of self-energy to, I mean, you can calculate self-energy as a whole, the self-energy. May I just show you some results I have some more model systems results, atomic limit and away from half occupation, but maybe I'll show you not self-energies but spectral functions for nickel oxide, which is a real system where we had introduced calculated k-dependent self-energies, and in a sense this is again a model system because this is nickel oxide in a paramagnetic phase, so it's a sort of a toy system in the sense that we are not claim to describe it as it should be anti-ferromagnetic, but we just use the paramagnetic phase to see whether just the Hubble correlation was able, even in the paramagnetic phase, to open up a gap. This is the density of state of nickel oxide calculated according to LDA, let's say, single particle theory. And this is what you do, what you get if you calculate hole and particle spectral functions, and so you see that you have a very strong rearrangement of all the spectrum, and the most important thing is that you have this opening up of a gap, separation between the hole and particle states, quasi-particle states, and moreover you have other short-lived excitations, these ones, which are the so-called satellites, which are well-known and have been measured.
The total density of state of the density of state.
This is the total density of states, as well as this one.
The dotted line is experiment?
Beg your pardon?
The dotted line
is the experiment. So what we have done here is trying to fix the satellite position and getting within this theory the correct gap.
So how are the U's and J's and so on?
In this case, just U.
The U was fitted or was?
It's fitted to. We
was
wanted
fitted to the location of that satellite.
We wanted to reproduce this satellite, and with this U, we were able to get the correct gas. I think it was around 9 electron volts.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's also you find here a gap, and you don't find a gap in the previous complex. There's a failure of you that in the previous complex
it was too small.
And the bandwidth, and this complex is larger than the bandwidth.
Yeah. This is it. I mean, I didn't show you this other view graph. The same density of state before, but with larger U. And you see that in this case you have a gap, separation between hosts.
You have to follow the sigma dependent on K?
I didn't get it.
So. In that model, did you take into account the dependence of sigma on K?
In the case of nickel oxide,
yes.
I did, yes, indeed. Yes, I haven't got the view graphs for the self energy, but I mean, it is there. And. Not as a function, a change sign as a function of K. The imaginary, no. No, it's, I mean, why should it? Well, but again, the ground state is non-interacting. Because
so
of.
She puts whatever the ground state is in.
Yeah.
And if that's wrong, then
the calculation isn't going to go. Yeah. And to do that, you should include more configurations. It can be done, but. Yeah, it can be done, but it's very hard. So, I wanted to show you some more results, rather system. Okay, just to show you how spectral, again, nickel oxide for a second. Here you have spectral functions as a function of K, and in this way you are just reproducing what experimentalists would get in an unresolved photoemission. So you have, before I was showing you the integration of these quantities, the summation over K, but you can of course plot. And in this way you would get the quasi-particle band structure, inclusive of satellites. And you can see that you have coherent quasi-particle peaks and incoherent ones, let's say satellites, associated to big imaginary, big size of the imaginary part of the self-energy. And we have tried also other systems like germanate, the well-known copper germanium oxygen 3, again starting from a band structure calculation where no instabilities, I mean just the plain copper germanium oxygen 3 without no spin pies or whatever. The Fermi level is here. This is just the whole spectrum. This is a single particle, and this is quasi particle. Let's say I'm plotting here in a continuous scale of gray the spectral functions, the spectral function in different k's. So you see that you have maxima, many more peaks, incoherent peaks, short-lived excitations in this view graph, and more important of that, you have the gap. So if you include Hubble correlation, you go from a metal to an insulator. Have I just... Sorry? I didn't get it, sorry. In particular from copper germanium oxygen 3, in this case what you expect is that the on-site correlation would be able to reproduce again the photoemission experiment, which predict the system to be, even in photoemission, I mean, an insulator. So you expect to see a gap. A gap, and if you would have more detailed experimental information, you would try to look at these incoherent short-lived excitations. Experimentally, they can be found looking at so-called resonant photoemission. In resonant photoemission, these incoherent satellites become huge. And in fact, there has been a study on copper germanium oxygen 3, not so detailed, just integrated photoemission, looking at the satellites, and this is what they get.
I mean, right against the gap, you don't find sharp quasi particle like
six. Yeah, no. You mean here? This. Yeah, you can have this incoherent. Actually, this incoherent part of the spectral function can appear not only at the high binding energy, but also up in energy, because you are starting from a very complex band structure, a very complex density of states, and you have many of these spikes in your imaginary part of the self-energy.
But it's the imaginary part of the self-energy is essentially zero in the gap, right?
Yeah,
spectral,
just
spectral,
yeah.
So I would think it would be very, very small, right next to the gap. So you would get sharp.
Yeah.
A sharp.
You don't get anything here.
Relatively sharp.
Yeah.
Bands, quasi particles near the gap.
No, but the Fermi energy is here, you know. And you are 2 eV below.
Right, but there's no spectral density in there.
No.
Extremely small.
Yeah.
So I would just expect, because the imaginary part is small, that the first quasi particle might be fairly sharp.
Unfortunately, I think I haven't got the. Maybe I have. No. Of course, I have the view graph of the imaginary part of the self energy in this energy region,
up,
but
could you put up the one before just to look?
You mean nickel oxide?
Yes. against the gap there, you have fairly sharp quasi particles.
Well, not here, for instance.
Okay, but that's right at the top.
You mean here? Here. Yeah. But I mean, the Fermi energy is zero, it's not 1 eV below.
Well, it's not particularly well defined here, is it?
Again, here it is defined because of the neutral ground state. The ground state is metallic.
The purity, right? The Fermi energy shifts to where the purity wants it to be, because insulator is not sharply defined.
No, but I mean the...
So the peak cannot depend on the location of the Fermi energy.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
when you would put in one impurity, all these peaks would become incoherent.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever,
mm-hmm.
in the
I think when you maybe a difference between having a spin polarized insulator or a paramagnetic MOS insulating state. In spin polarized insulator, you do expect things were now talking about the paramagnetic MOS insulating state to actually have
this theory
going to zero without a sharp peak at the gap.
Mm-hmm.
This theory is not doing some fancy spin liquid.
Right. No, I'm not talking about spin liquid. I'm talking about.
Yeah, this is zero temperature theory, right?
I'm just saying something very trivial, it's nothing fancy. If you just take paragraph 3 to describe a paramagnetic MOS insulator, you have a spectral density which vanishes. If you lose spin density weight for spin polarized insulator, you have
to agree that Hilbert Street produces an object which is at long wavelength completely in physical and pathological, right? You shouldn't take it seriously. Right? And I think that's the same thing here. You cannot ask the theory to do the long wavelength part, sharpness of the lowest line excitation, etc. correctly. I guess that's the answer. Like the rich sweep. There are no principles out there in fact.
Okay. I would have some more recent results. On a metal, and I would be pleased to show them to you. It's just nickel. In this case, this is the ferromagnetic nickel, and in this particular case, we are just interested in what is happening very close to the Fermi energy. So this may be interesting for this discussion. So this is again, this is the spectral function scale resolved for LDA. It comes out from a single particle picture.
Which would actually be delta functions, right?
Big bang?
Actually be delta functions in LDA.
Well, there is a small imaginary part added, the experimental broadening. And this is what comes out of this quasi-part three-body scattering theory. And you see that the overall change is, again, very big. Notice that this energy region is quite small. It's just one eV below the Fermi energy. And these are experiments, and very highly energy resolved experiments. And if you look at this picture as a whole, you'd see that this theory reproduces much better the experiments. And this is shown even more clearly here. We're just choosing some spectral functions. Yes, it is ferromagnetic. Here it is integrated, I mean, no distinction between spin up and spin down. This is the black curve is the experiment, and the blue one is the quasi-particle spectral function. The same K here, this is the LVA again, and different K vectors. You see that you have a much nicer agreement between what is seen experimentally if you remove one particle and if you calculate the one particle removal. And the last thing that I would like to discuss with you is the fact that these self-energy corrections are highly spin-dependent. I mean, not only the ground state is, of course, depends on spin, but also the self-energy correction. And I will show you the same view graph resolved in spin. And again, the experiment and the theory, LDA and three-body scattering. And you see this yellow thing is spin down, the green spin up. And you see that this, the yellow peaks are shifted less than the green ones. So you expect majority spin to be more affected by correlation than minority ones. Why this is it? In fact, the self-energy is spin-dependent, and you understand this picture, this scattering picture I was showing you, this comes out very easily. The scattering channels for involving spin-up and spin-down electrons are less, I mean, at different efficiency. For instance, if you remove one particle from the majority spin band, the hole and particle states which come into play are these. This is fully, of course, this is schematization. This is the completely filled majority spin band. And you see that the scatterings between holes and electron holes, the scattering efficiency is proportional to U because opposite spin electrons are involved. If you, on the contrary, if you remove one minority spin, again, the only way to create an extra electron hole pair is to add it at the same spin. So, because here you have no place to, you have no empty states, or at least you have few of them. So in this case, the scattering efficiency the intensity of the scattering is lower, because now you have scattering between parallel spin electrons, and which would depend on U minus J. So you'd expect a different rearrangement of spin up and spin down bands as an effect of this on-site correlation. I think I can stop here. Yeah.
To the other way to incorporate correlation bands like it was used. What are the differences or advantages or disadvantages?
Okay. Well, maybe Vladimir would speak about that. But I mean, I would like to answer. Vladimir, wait a minute. My answer would be that LDA plus U is a mean field theory. It doesn't calculate self-energy. I mean, self-energy is real in a sense. So you are not going to have an imaginary part of the self-energy. So you are not going to have satellites, short-lived excitations, and things like that. So this is not LDA plus U, because the self-energy has also an imaginary part. And this is the main difference, I would say.
Okay.
This is a real theory for the single particle green.
Sure. Mm-hmm. The question was, there are at least two aspects of your results. One is to get the gross energetics right, mm-hmm. and then the second aspect is to get the lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And would it be an alternative to start from Elliott plus U and then do something similar to what you did? Then you have the energetics.
Well, this is a possibility. All this story is quite independent on the starting point.
If you start, for example, copper dominated, knowing that you have your stuff is a process which is a matter.
Yeah.
And then you calculate the excitation, you find them to be gas.
The excitation if you remove one particle, not the excited state of the neutral system, but the ground state of the charged system. So this is how a hole would propagate, the hole propagator.
Is it so? Did you try this? When you start out, say, even nickel oxide, you can do LSDA and find this little gap, and then do this sleep particle business.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get the same answer as starting with the metal? Have you tried it?
Not myself, but other people have. And actually, as I was saying before, starting from Hartree Fock, even, which...
Because it's a huge gap, part of the gap, sort of, it all the time.
Yeah.
So your starting point really just supplies a single particle basis?
In a sense, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
We have a thermal liquid. In other words, what does the equation say about thermal liquid parameters, which is presumably that's what you would be calculating.
It looks
like you're always using it to get gaps,
to get
semiconductor preoccupation, and you look as if you're real game, but then the worrying about the generality of the method is can we do real metals?
Well, nickel
metals are vegetable because they don't have a gap, but then they do have a Fermi liquid ground state, which is a very serious issue, and one would like to know whether the Fayev equations predict correct self energies describing the lifetime of the quantum particle going to infinity in a particular way, and giving you the Fermi liquid parameters.
Concerning lifetime at the Fermi energy in a metal, like in nickel, you do. You have the correct going to zero of the imaginary part of the self energy. And actually, the last result I've shown you is just on nickel, which is a metal, and this issue of Fermi liquid or non-Fermi liquid can be addressed experimentally and theoretically. And at this level, I have just shown a way where the two things match. The photo emission, which measures lifetimes and the peaks and spectral functions.
Photo emission can't see the Fermi surface.
To
be a metal, it's not to see optical peaks in 2 eV below the Fermi energy to see that whether you have a metal or not. You have to say that it has a Fermi surface. The lifetimes can come to infinity, then the momentum distribution has a discontinuity. That is the defining property of the Fermi liquid ground state. That's the fixed point. And the construction of that is, of course, everybody's very interested in. And the question is whether this method is...
Yeah.
The
only way, the direct way I see answer this question is looking into quasi-particle lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And we have done this, and
it seems quite nice. You calculate something frame with the experiment.
We have, actually. I have some results for nickel. In a small part of the Fermi, I can show you if you like.
We have the Fermi liquid parameters measured. People have measured the resistivity, the T-squared part, and then you measure susceptibilities, and etc. So we don't have experimental evidence of what the Fermi liquid parameters are, and the question is, does this method give you numbers that that are right?
Well, the problem is again that this method describes the removal of one particle, and in this context the only answer I can give the concerning is Fermi liquid theory right, is there, is concerning lifetime of this excitation. But I mean, all what has to do with the neutral ground state is a bit, I mean, I cannot. This is it.
I mean, you sort of remark, let's say early 90s, Dr. Farma and Dr. Rubinstein were involved sort of a year-long project trying to sort out if you could find in this Valdeyev level of approximation different ways of making non-Fermi liquid.
Mm-hmm.
I like to say that at the end of the run there was sort of hopeful at some point. I mean, it's this remarkable thing that you can make insulators out of metallic ground state. That's one of these peculiarities of this level theory. But I think at the end of the run they found that you couldn't really be the Fermi liquid. Right? So when they say wanted to stay a Fermi liquid, not an insulator, right? And if I wanted to say a metal, I should say it was a Fermi liquid. They really went searching for possibilities to make non-Fermi liquids, right? Using the three particle scattering. And it didn't work. But I like to say it's quite stable. When you have a Fermi liquid, it stays a Fermi liquid, and of course you have quantitative issues like the value of Fermi liquid parameters.
That's
the question, point I can ask.
Yes, one more. For the future, you could tell that you did not fit U for nuclear site, that you used Abinich calculated because 8.5 V is exactly what we get in concentration. So it looks much better.
The same is for nickel, by the way. I mean, it's also.
So why do you say that you fit it?
Okay, I won't.
Okay. Thank you.
You have a initial creative density to say, and which can be
you
and then you compute technically the, the green function? You restrict your space of the state, right? And then you. You exact diagonalization or something?
No. No. The way it is done, it is like that. I mean, as I was saying, you have this three body scattering thing, and what you do, you have to, you have this thing to calculate. This is, and you have to, the matrix element of it, and I can show you in a view graph. So maybe it's a bit tricky, but I mean, just to have an indication of it is done, because I had no time to. Okay, let me see if I can find it. What is that? Okay. No. Here? No, this is something. Okay. Here we are. Okay. This is how it is done. Shall we put here? So you are interested in this?
Yeah.
But you can focus on this smaller thing, which is this resolvent of just the three body part of the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
This in turn, so if you have F3, you can calculate G by Dyson equation, including the extra term which have been neglected here. And then you have to calculate F3, and this is done according to the scattering, I mean, calculating scattering operator. Actually, in practice, what you have to do is to solve just an integral equation in terms of.
I mean. So, these Feynman diagrams you you saw had
they were
three lines.
No, so just three.
Just three lines.
Because there are three. Actually, they are not. It's the way
there is
a hierarchy. The equation. I mean, you should write the equation of motion and things like that.
All your Feynman diagrams has three lines.
Then but I don't use them.
Why? Yes. But why do you claim that your method is not perturbative? Because I can write a lot of
Dyson equation. The Dyson equation as such is non-perturbative. The way you solve it, generally it is. But if you would able to exactly invert it,
and
this is what I do.
Yes.
I mean, I am exactly calculating and solving an integral equation.
Using a kind of Dyson equation.
Not real. I mean. I'm solving a sort of Dyson equation exactly by solving an integral equation exactly, connecting these different scattering operators. But I'm not doing a cutting any, I mean, there is no perturbative order cut, I mean, it's just an exact inversion of the, if you like, Dyson equation.
But then you have diagrams, you must have diagrams with more than three lines at the same time. If not, because for example, the RPA or other sums of a complete series of diagrams are perturbative.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Okay, I see what you mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I was showing here is the... Okay, I'll show you. But I mean, I'm not using as a mean of calculation the Feynman diagram. I want to be clear on that. Where is that? This U graph. Okay, you mean this one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the bare three particle one, but these are dressed, I mean.
Yeah.
So
yes.
In this sense, and you have this self energy.
Yeah.
So you. This is not a perturbative expansion, and it's sort of a graphic summary of what it looks like.
Okay.
I don't know if I have answered to your question. Okay.
Could you write yours down?
What you say about your paper? That's doing a pretty solid paper. How is the order for the same company? So we have some papers before on chromial stuff.
Mm-hmm. Is that the half-metallic one? Or
no, this is just a standard anti-ferromagnet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this group in Dortmund. They started this chromium doing this nonlinear magnetic object and going to ethermanganate. So you can match the domain. You can see optically the anti-ferromagnetic domain is the length and wire. Before you put it, that one is a Newton scattering, right? But in this material, you can see this nonlinear object, so there's this FHT there.
Mm-hmm.
Second number in the
noise. Right.
And then there are about other materials. This question is very well interested. I mean, if you see an optic, anti-ferromagnetic domain, you must have a way to couple light to an order parameter.
And so that was
through
the magneto-electric coupling thing?
Well, actually, this was here, it was through, you need spin orbit coupling, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, here, it's a magneto to ask the same question.
Right.
Okay.
I should look at that paper again.
asked because we are really don't really have a background in neuroelectrics.
Right. Yeah, mine is actually I did my postdoctoral research in a neuroelectrics field group. So there's a little bit of them for a year, but that was But yeah, why don't we talk on Monday maybe? When Rosea?
Yeah.
Is that a woman or
a woman? Yeah,
she's a
woman, yeah.
And she's from...
Actually,
she's
my wife.
Oh, okay.
We're working together, physics. So. She's Spanish.
Okay.
Oh, Kerala. It's a Kerala name.
Oh. Yeah, I think I'm free. Pretty much
What is Matthias Hansen doing here, or what?
There's a lot of semiconductor quantum dots work. That's probably the biggest single for us. So gallium nitride is really big. Quantum dots. There's a start. We're starting to work on magnetic semiconductors and magnetic quantum dots.
Electronics.
Right. We just got a new MBE machine and a big grant from the Defense Research Agency. And then some oxides.
So in this workshop, there was also discussion about, already discussion about spin electrons, but this is one of the subjects.
Yeah, we had a little, we talked a little, well, I guess we talked, we started off with kind of this ferromagnetic ferroelectric material.
Because I would like to know a little bit about the basics, because not my background. So
what are the ideas in that field? Right. Well, you know, ferromagnetic semiconductors are a big, trying to make a semiconductor that is also a ferromagnet.
What do you want to do with that?
Well, if you want to do any kind of spin polarized electronics, you want it to be compatible with semiconductor crystalline technology. So you don't want to put metals and I think the big problem at the moment is to get spin polarization. If you want to do it by transport rather than by optics, then you have to use a metal. Or some kind of ferromagnet, which is generally not a semiconductor.
Yeah.
And so when you make a semiconductor metal interface, you get spin scattering in the middle of
So but how would you like to get a spin polarized
semiconductor? Electric? If you dope a 3-5 with a divalent transition metal ion, so the one that they're doing at the moment, this is not well understood, it's kind of empirical. Gallium manganese arsenide, this goes in divalent, the electrons, and there's some kind of magnetic moment coupling between fairly distant manganese ions.
Remind me, manganese is how many D?
So it's 5D. So the largest possible magnetic moment. But somehow these get coupled ferromagnetically by the Holt. And so this is an empirical fact. It's totally not understood why.
Do you get a small polarization or already realized or still in the
In the lab. The curing temperature is still only around 100 Kelvin. So actually this is another material that we're working on in my group trying to understand.
And so why do they like to have I didn't understand but already the basic question.
Why spin polarized electronics?
Yeah.
I guess it's the most kind of the most really basic level is that so you can have twice as much information if you have up and down.
I see.
You can have it's also compatible with magnetic data storage technology. So the idea of making kind of spin valves, I guess you have a ferromagnet polarized and then the shred polarized that way, there's no conduction, whereas if it's polarized this way, then you get electron propagation. So there are quite a few, this kind of setup I think is already in commercial production because of memory data storage. It's radiation hard. If you make a data bit like the storage bit like this rather than transistors, it's radiation hard. So you put in satellites and military applications, which is a big funding source.
I didn't know that the military was
interested. Right, yeah. So and it's non-volatile.
Well, I came here, I wanted to learn a little bit about that.
There's not much material. Well, there's not much materials interest in this community, I think, in here.
Well, of course. Obviously, theory.
Right, but it's
Institute of Theoretical Physics.
It's very, very on the theoretical physics end of the theoretical physics.
Spectrum, you know. Probably the string theory with the TSE.
It's even more so, but there's not much.
You know what string theory is?
They feel that very distant.
But
they're very much on the kind of physics end of the spectrum, I think. Mm-hmm. There seems to be much more. The emphasis is really on the quantum, main body interaction.
So much. How many people are they doing SFRS? I want to find somebody to motivate to better structure regulation, you know, mm-hmm. Different material. We were also working on another system, just NR2-05, sodium malate.
Warren might have done some work on that.
That could be, yeah. And there's now one, which is, I think, copper 2.3, no, sorry, 2/3, so 0.6, E205. Which becomes superconducting under pressure. But maybe more, yes.
So he did a systematic search for half, computational search for half metallic antiferromagnetic.
Yeah, I know that. It's a nice project.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think he looked at Benedict and kind of double perovskite structures.
I think the first superconducting oxide, which is where it is. Well, there's copper inside, but the electronic active orbitals are the vanadium.
Mm-hmm.
So on the atomic level, there's the vanadium,
mm-hmm.
and there's no oxygen on the copper on the atomic level.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, some weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.